Good afternoon and welcome to the latest episode of Darren Matthews and Sometimes Friends. I am joined today by a former Antrim County footballer, current St. Gall's netminder and our mental health advocate, Chris Kerr. Chris, say hello.
Hello, Darren. Thanks for having us.
No problem, dude. Have you on today. We are going to talk about some serious stuff and then we're going to talk about some good crack stuff and we'll try and keep it informative yet entertaining for the listeners. So we should start off by explaining that we've already recorded this podcast.
We have. We just didn't pick our setting properly.
No, we sort of haven't seen each other for a few years. We're like, let's meet up. I know this nice wee cafe up the Lisburn Road, Belfast. We got in. It was nice and chilled. We ordered the coffees. We sat down. And as soon as we started recording, four of the noisiest women I've ever encountered sat about 15 feet away from us.
Yeah, four middle-aged women. Full of caffeine on the Lisburn Road, probably slapping about their husbands. Just sat down, dancing, and it didn't work out too well.
It didn't, because they were having a great time, and we were discussing some very serious topics, which doesn't really set the mood or the tone of the podcast when they're giggling away in the corner.
And if they can talk over myself or you, then if they were loud.
And that's, and sitting halfway across the cafe as well, which was nuts. So yeah, Chris, I got Chris to come down to do the podcast because I've interviewed now one of my musician mates. I've done interviews with some of the comedians and stuff, so I thought I'd try and branch into stuff that is now a massive impact on our society here in Ireland, in the north and the south, all over the world, but seems to be especially here in Belfast, especially in the news and especially in the last couple of weeks. Chris, I asked you to come down because like you do a lot of stuff, advocacy for mental health.
Yeah, I same sort of thing. So, you know, I was always reading about suicides in West Belfast in particular, but, you know, obviously across the city. And I felt that if I could put my own sort of mental health troubles that I had into a bit of a blog through the GPA, the Gaelic Players Association, and it sort of went public. I just felt that if somebody could read it and go and get help themselves, or it was a kick up the backside to go and get help, then that was the plan. So from then I've just been sort of going around different clubs and schools and different even businesses, you know, relaying that message. And you know, even recently Spicy Inn West Belfast with the amount of suicides, and even more recently even in the Holy Lands, the two students Dan as well. So it's pretty serious.
I know you said that you do this and you go around and give talks and stuff. Did that decision come from using your kind of public profile as a county footballer, or because obviously you had to have your own personal experience first, so and that's what's detailed in your blog? So
yeah, probably yeah, I suppose people can relate to people playing sport, and you know, GAA is big in Belfast and in Antrim and in general. So I felt that if people could relate to just someone normal that goes and plays Gaelic, you know, was very lucky to have been pretty successful with St. Gall's, played a lot of times for Antrim, you know, over 100 times. So if someone could look on and go, well, he went and got help, then, you know, it's okay for me to go and do it too. So that was basically the thinking behind it all.
I think maybe coming from a sporting background myself, we almost see those, like people who play at county level and stuff, you're at a new level of training, but that's a whole other level of pressure as well. So you're talking about people that have to, like we talked before, and you said like the GPA have systems in place to help county footballers.
Yeah. Yeah, they're very good. You know, they have their own counselling services that you can ring a confidential line anytime, you know, 365 days a year, 24/7 they're available. So, you know, the GPA are very good in terms of looking after the county players, I suppose, you know, the way the games went, where, you know, it's training 5-6 nights a week. GPA done a study last year where most players on average are given 31 hours a week on top of, you know, their jobs and whatever else they have going on in their lives, which is a lot of commitment, and there's no real time left for themselves. So, you know, the GPA are very aware of that in terms of sort of protecting their players and looking after them.
Now, see, specifically that's the GPA, and because of people like yourself going around and you're doing talks in clubs, we're dealing with underage players, we're dealing with senior players. but that's in one organization. Do you feel like the organizations are picking up the slack because our actual own mental health services are so lacking?
Yeah, it probably doesn't help that we haven't had a sitting government, you know, for, you know, I don't even know how long it is now.
Is it 2.5 years?
It must be, you know, like it is. I think we'll hold the record again for something, you know.
Horrendous.
It's not a record we should be proud of. So, you know, there's a lot of charities, there's a lot of, you know, community groups doing really good things, and when you don't have that funding or that sort of leadership directing the sort of, or, you know, sort of steering the ship in the direction that's needed, then it's difficult, especially with the sort of, you know, you can call it an epidemic that is here. You know, there's more people that have died from suicide from the signing of the Good Friday Agreement than there was in 30 years of conflict, which is mad when you think of it. Like,
it's a shocking figure, because if over 3,000 people were killed in the Troubles, that was over 30 years now, over 20 years we're talking about a higher number.
Yeah, and most, and it's probably even higher, because when you go into hospital or someone's attempted suicide and they've still been alive in hospital, and then when they're actually, it could be down to heart failure that they've sadly passed away, then that death then is registered as heart failure, and it's not a suicide. So the number's probably even bigger. So it's for such a small place in terms of population, it's really worrying.
From that idea, as we talked about, it could be registered as something else. Is that a social stigma we have here?
Yeah,
that has to be, where it's, oh my god, that happened that week, and you're like, yes, but it does happen, and it's happening more.
Yeah.
And because we can't talk about it, it's gonna keep getting worse.
No, it is, and it's only when sort of, you know, it's when you're reading about it that everyone's like, right, we need to do something, and then it sort of dies down again, and then it's always wait until it's another tragic story or another, you know, it's not necessarily a young life, but it could be, you know, it's any age, you know, it varies from, you know, we've heard from the age of 10 right up to the men and women in their 60s. So you know, it's something that's just sort of spiraled out of control here, like, and it just seems to be, for a lot of people, it's the option that they feel that they need to take.
Yeah, from that, I mean, we talked about how you ended up becoming an advocate for this, and how you ended up, once you retired, now you've been asked to go around and do these chats. Do you want to, I mean, it's in the blog and stuff, but do you want to do a wee summary of what your own journey was? Because this had to start somewhere for you, and before you were helping other people, there had to be that time where it was just you in your own head.
I had to help myself. So it was, my dad was, he was diagnosed with cancer in 2012. Was told basically he had 9 months to live. He was a big smoker. He would have smoked probably 40 plus a day, you know, from the age of probably 14, 15, right up until, you know, he passed away at 59. So I think just through the whole process where you're sort of thinking, you know, if anyone will get over it, it'll be him and it'll be a success story. But, you know, it didn't work out that way. And it was, you know, it was probably more the roller coaster effect of, you know, seeing him doing well, nearly convincing yourself that, oh, he's going to do well here. And then a few days later, he could be, you know, on his hands and knees crawling to a bathroom where you have to lift him, or lifting your own dad and stuff, which is not something you sort of ever envisage doing, like. But and then he passed away in February 2013, and then it was basically, I threw myself back into training, playing. I was working a temporary job at the time, like a 52-week contract, like civil service posts. And I just went back to working, playing, training, and just sort of felt that was my way of getting on with it and sort of being in a routine. And, you know, as time was coming on, or it was going on, sorry, it was becoming sort of more irritable and nearly withdrawn from things, and started really, you know, all I ever wanted to do was just lie in bed, and didn't really want to bother with people. And this was going on, and then I was having to go to Gaelic training. Like, my biggest thing was, I kept going to training and playing because I never wanted that sort of bravado that I was sort of putting on, or that mask to slip, which in hindsight was obviously the wrong thing to do. So I felt that it Eventually it just came to a head. I was about maybe 8-9 months later, just competing a championship match with Antrim, and that sort of started the process. I went out on the drink after the match, and then went out sort of 2 days in a row on the drink, which I probably shouldn't have done, because I wasn't feeling great, and you know, I never attempted anything, but you know, suicidal thoughts were becoming, you know, the main sort of, they were the most prominent thought in my head.
Was this the conflict between keeping up appearances and how you actually feel?
Yeah, that was it as well. You know, I was able,
because the boys are going on the second day, so you better show up. And
yeah, and like, you know, and anyone that sort of knows me, and you know, probably just a typical goalkeeper, just usually the loudest person and in the middle of the crack and always cracking jokes and trying to make other people laugh, and you know, trying to keep up that act, but also battling with when I was going home and on my own. All I wanted to do was lie about and didn't really want to bother with anyone. So I got in touch with the GPA after that. They got me set up with a counsellor, and then initially went to counselling, was arguing with myself sort of whether to go in or not, or text the fella and say, you know, just cancel it, I couldn't be bothered with the hassle. But I did go in and stuck at the counselling for about a year, felt like I sort of plateaued with it, so I went to my GP, tried medication, didn't really work for me, but I know other people that it's worked really well for, it just didn't sort of mix well with me, and was making me sort of, I was really tired during the day, but wide awake at night, and you know, it was shocking. I was getting a job where it was sort of a hostile environment as well, which was adding to the whole thing, sort of fueling the fire, making it worse. So I got in touch with GPA again, and they got me set up with a CBT counsellor, cognitive behavioural therapy, and that was a sort of turning point for us. It was after about maybe 2-3 years of trying the counselling, the medication, and the CBT sort of helps you sort of manage your thoughts and be a bit more rational in terms of, you know, if you have a bad 20 minutes or a bad hour in work, that it's not necessarily a bad day, it's just a bad hour, and not making mountains out of molehills, which I was really good at. So I think that was a big turning point. And I sort of felt over the last couple of years, you know, always reading about, you know, West Belfast being the highest suicide rates, and especially in young men, and that was where the idea came from, to sort of put it out there.
Yeah, well, the thing is as well, I mean, I know you were saying the GPA helped you and stuff. Was there anyone else you saw stepping forward that, or did you just have enough yourself and you thought, I have to do this, or was there someone else that you...
I'd seen another guy, like, with the GPA. He was a goalkeeper as well, Alan O'Mara.
Kevin, was it?
Kevin, goalkeeper, Alan O'Mara. And his was different. His was, you know, different circumstances. Completely different, sort of. His was about football. And but it was just, when I was reading his, it felt like the same. Like, it was the same sort of feelings, and but completely different circumstances, so
the circumstance that leads you to it can be anything, but near the end result is, this is how I'm feeling, and this is what I share with those other people.
Yeah,
is this what you share when you're doing your talks?
Yeah, as well. It just, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, grief. Mine was losing my dad, but it could be someone with a gambling problem, financial problems, relationship problems, losing a job, you know, anything. So I think a lot of the feelings of being depressed and anxious are all sort of similar.
Yeah. Is there, do you think, do we have a reason why it's so bad here in this country?
It's hard to put finger on, really. You know, it's just seems like it's a sort of thing to do for especially a lot of younger people, you know. You know, if it's drink, drugs, you know, it's an issue that seems to be getting out of control now as well. Storm out, not sitting, there's no sort of leadership there for people to really go to, and funding to be released for services. You know, you read the likes of Australia have mental health days where people can phone into work and say that they're feeling, you know, anxious or depressed, and that's treated the same way as you would ring in and say, you know, I don't feel well, I've been up sick all night.
Yeah.
Which I know, I think everyone's done that at some stage over the years, but if you were to ring into a job and say, listen, here especially, I don't really feel well, I feel a bit depressed, you know, the answer would be, give yourself a shake and come on in.
I mean, I've worked in construction and hospitality and stuff, and it would just be, get up that ladder, let's go, good day's work will sort you out. But sometimes that can be worse because you've so much time in your own head.
Yeah.
Like you're working away, but it's always there.
In the forefront, and you're not, you know, if you're doing a job, you're not really thinking about it properly. You're doing it sort of half-arsed, really.
Yeah.
Your concentration levels are all over the place, and you're probably a million miles away where you should be, especially if you're working in a sort of a manual labor job, like, which could lead to, you know, bad injuries and all too, like, so.
Definitely.
I think it's something that needs to be looked at here, especially.
The thing we talk about, sort of no Stormont sitting, so we can't pass new legislation. The problem is, before Stormont even left, we just did not have funding for mental health, which is now being picked up. The slack is being picked up by charities, so they have to raise their own funding to actually help people. And like, it's so strange because here, and like you talk about West Belfast, but all over the north and all over Ireland, there are so many people willing to help.
Yeah.
But I'm sure for a lot of people who are like yourself, mental health, they must look at the figures and it must feel like swimming in the tide.
Yeah, it's just their hands are tied because it's somewhere, I think, for every time, every suicide costs in around 1.6 million. And that's to do with, you know, funerals, the knock-on effect of so many friends, family members that need, you know, counselling, medication, whatever professional services that they require to sort of try and help them. So, you know, you hear different figures, like £1 million has been put into the trust. You know, that doesn't even cover one person, or
yeah, but they're thinking on the basis, oh, that'll pay for two nurses.
I know.
Or
yeah,
a mobile counselling service.
So like, it's hard. Like I don't know what to do. Like, or you know, the amount of money that's required, especially for mental health services, is, you know, it's a big figure. Like,
I always found it strange with our health services, especially mental health services, if we are getting our money from Westminster because Stormont's not sitting, or even if we're given our go away money every year from the British government, and then they say, right, this is allocation of services and councils, we're a small population. Surely we should be the easiest to look after.
Yeah.
And yet we have the highest rates of this stuff.
I know. The highest rates, you know, coming out the back of a conflict as well. You know, for a lot of people, you know, when you really look into it, there's a lot of people there that have, for one reason or not, have been, you know, got prison time where they don't really, and that's on their records, where they can't really apply for jobs. You know, they've nowhere else to turn. They turn to drugs, they turn to drink, and then one thing leads to another. So, especially in a lot of areas across Belfast and the north, as you say, you know, everywhere's been affected by it. So, you know, there's obviously a knock-on effect or some form of link there. Like,
yeah, I think it's crazy. So from we first recorded this, which we then had, now we're doing the re-record, it's once again, from that week from we talked, it's back in the news.
There's
two young people at university in Belfast.
Yeah, there's been four or five that I've heard of in the last sort of week. And as you say, they mentioned the two students, you know, starting university, should be one of the best times for them, you know, starting freshers week, moving up, living with their housemates, and sadly, you know, they've felt they've no other way out for whatever reason it was. It's very sad.
It's definitely, yeah, it's a strange start to the year, I'm sure, for a lot of people, and they're coming up with their mates, and this is all, that's the whole year blown, probably. This is that, all that stuff happens.
Yeah, it's even that, you know, their parents think they're going up, and, you know, I've heard, you know, people going up, get a degree, and, you know, that's the start of their sort of children fled in the nest sort of thing. And, you know, it's even the friends and families and the housemates who'll be affected. And, you know, they sort of say it's between 50 and 100 people end up being affected by, you know, one person that commits suicide. So it's sad to see, especially in young people as well, when they've so much to, you know, to live for and look forward to, and sadly they feel that was the only option for them.
When you started, so once people read your blog, and I actually read your piece when it was in the Irish News, that's where I first became aware, and I was like, I used to play football with that guy.
Yeah, yeah.
That's where I figured out from your story. When you go and do talks to other people, is talking to a group and sharing your experience, is it easier because once you've said it for the first time, it's out there? Is that the hardest one?
Don't know. Like, you know, Stephen,
I'm sure it's never easy to talk to, but you are, your experience, if it helps one person.
Yeah, well, that's it. And I know, like, you know, it's still, even I would be quite anxious in terms of, like, even speaking in front of people or in crowds. But, you know, finitely that, you know, even the facts are there that 1 in 4 people will either be affected or know someone. So, and ultimately my side of things with losing my dad, everyone's going to lose their parents at some stage as well. So everyone can sort of relate to that in a way. So, I suppose, and you know, if I can, as I say, all I wanted to do was if I could help one person, it sort of, it spiraled more out of control than I thought it would. And a lot more people have contacted me saying that they've, you know, it felt like it was them writing it, and, you know, they've held on to those sort of feelings for 20 years and that sort of brought it to the surface. So it's good that it can touch so many people and, you know, help them get help too.
Okay, so we talked about the GPA having a service. You're a former county footballer, or when you were a county footballer. With the funding or with the charities, what else, what other options are available to people? Because I think one of the things is, if people have that degree of hopelessness, they don't know where to turn.
Yeah.
Like when I was feeling low, when I went to my GP, the first thing my GP said was, do you want me to prescribe you something?
Yeah.
And I said, no. I said, I just had to tell somebody.
Yeah, yeah.
And I read that you can talk confidentially with your GP. And I said, but straight away when they were like, do you want to do that? And I was like, no, I want to know what my other options are.
Yeah.
And one of the things that got me, I had a bad breakup. It was like the end of a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And I was living in Australia at the time. And one of my mates, a lad from West Belfast, he was a personal trainer. And he says, I'll take you to the gym. And I was like, I don't want to go to the fucking gym.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I'd never been in the gym. I just always played football and run around. That wasn't what I did. You know, I'm a social footballer. He says, I'll take you to the gym. And I was like, what good's that going to do me? He was just come with me. And we went a couple of sessions and he looked after me, showed me how to do it myself.
Yeah.
So I could start going on my own.
Yeah.
And that was, to be honest, that was a big help. And so whenever I'm having a bad day, I try and get to the gym.
Yeah, I would be the same. You know, I would always stick to sort of, you know, routine. If I'm in a good routine, you know, eating well as well, exercising, not even like, you know, Gaelic training or a championship match or anything. It might just be going for a walk with your earphones in just to get out and a bit of fresh air or two. You know, there is confidential lanes available. There's doctors. There's walk-in centres across the city as well that you can self-refer to. I think as a society, we should be trying to, you know, even in workplaces and in like sports clubs, you know, especially GAA, which we know well ourselves, creating environments where it's okay to speak about your mental sort of injuries, as opposed to just, you know, we're all quick to speak about the physical injuries that we pick up playing, or, you know, just injuries in general. So I think making it normal to speak about having mental health problems or mental health issues is a long way to go, where people go, do you know what, he's speaking about it, or he's went and got help, I can go and do that too. And
yeah,
it's sort of normalized, as opposed to go, God, he's depressed, or he's got anxiety, I don't know about that. You know, there's still that sort of cloud around it. And sort of the older generation would be very much, you know, man up, give yourself a shake, wise up. You know, you've heard all them words before. And I think generally the sort of tide is starting to turn. I think a lot more people through the likes of, you know, social media gets a lot of bad light, but I think it's good things as well in terms of being able to promote it and sort of put messages out there where, you know, we're all buried in our phones now, like, so everyone reads either Twitter or Facebook or Instagram, or, you know,
so if we can make those more blogs, positive places, yeah,
as opposed to the negative light that they get as well, you know, I think it's a good,
I only mention that because when I joined, because I'm from Armagh, but when I moved back up to Belfast, I joined a team up in West Belfast. I'm just a reserve team, St. Paul's.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the older guys that plays there, he speaks openly about his mental health issues.
Yeah.
He was like, oh yeah, I was in the hospital last year. But he's obviously either such a success story or his counselling's gone so well, or but he's still working at it.
Yeah.
But he comes to football and it's his social thing, and lovely dude, and it was just proof positive to me that this could happen to anybody, you know what I mean? This guy was probably a senior footballer for 20 years and everything from the outside looks great.
Yeah, it was just probably the same as myself, you know, looking in, going, well, sure, he's winning championships and stuff with St. Gall's, you know, we had won, you know, X amount of championships, Ulster club titles, All-Ireland club titles, playing for Antrim, was captain of Antrim at a stage too. So from the outside looking in, plus the biggest messer in the change room, always joking and laughing, and the biggest sort of response I would have got was, you're the last person I would ever have thought of, you know, that would ever felt like that, you would ever imagine. So, as you say, it's like that sort of advert about the black dog. You mightn't necessarily kick it or get rid of it, but you can sort of, you can minimize the shadow it holds over you, or the, you know, you can control it as opposed to it controlling you. And I think as long as you have sort of mechanisms and plans in place to manage it, then that's the biggie. Like,
when you came forward yourself, as you said, people came up to you and says, oh, I would never would have expected you.
Yeah.
Is that's obviously how tight your mask was on.
Oh yeah, I became like
in public persona, and as soon as you closed the door behind you, you were back into the bad times. Like,
it was I sort of referenced it to the way, sort of, you know, favourite films, Batman. So, you know, he was able to put on that sort of mask, and or the Dark Knight, you know, was able to put on that sort of mask, and everyone thought it was a sort of a superhero. And you know, when the mask came off, he was just a normal person that had his own demons. And I think that's the same. Like, you know, I was very good at pretending, you know, crack the odd joke and sort of, you know, put out the fires where people were like, ah, you're right, or, you know, anytime it sort of come up, I would sort of do something to sort of deflected or what. And you know, so I was good at doing that, which was a bad thing.
Well, that's a realization, it's a bad thing now, if people nearly didn't believe when you came forward.
Yeah, I know. I think a lot of people were in shock, you know, especially, you know, I end up telling a few of my close friends, so they sort of knew. But I think the, you know, boys I played for Antrim with were like, god, you would never have seen that coming. So it just shows you how people say look out for signs, but sometimes it's hard to look out for signs, you know. It's especially people that can hate it so well, like especially Irish males as well have this thing where you'd be like, nah, I'm grand, nothing's wrong with me, like, sort of thing. So
yeah,
it's a big one too.
The one I want to lead on to, when you came forward with all this, you wrote your blog, you were still playing for Antrim, weren't you?
Yeah, I was. It was last year, so it was just the start of National League last year.
Yeah, so but from that basis, like, you tackled that when you were still in your county career, even if you were coming out of it. But there's so many boys that guys like dedicate their life. It could be minors right through to seniors, right? What do those guys do when they're done? You know what I mean? Because there's thanks for your service, and
that's it.
People forget your name.
I know, that's it. Like, it's sort of, it's a tough one. Like, you know, this whole amateur, people say about, you know, we keep the amateur ethos, and that's all well and good, but when people are playing at that level for so long, as you say, like, you know, it could be best part of 10, 15 years of somebody's life. You know, it was my whole adult life I was doing it. So probably came the right time too. Like, you know, it was just sort of, you know, I'd played for so long, and slowly but surely I was becoming the oldest one out of all the sort of my age group. And just with the amount of commitment and traveling, and, you know, it's 5 nights a week now, like, you know, regardless, that's the limit, or that's, you know, the minimum now, like, 5 nights, and that's between pitch and gym and whatever else. And it's when you're trying to go to work the next day, getting up, making food and having your lunches ready for the next day, like, you know, it's just like, when do you ever have time just to sit down, even, and just lie down for half an hour? Like, you know, that wasn't.
And you think that is the time for sort of your, whether it be your mindfulness or your meditation or your, you know, all these new ideas which are now being brought in. I mean, the stuff that is now within the GAA and within mental health, we would have laughed at 10, 15 years ago.
Oh, definitely. And you can even, you hear all these sort of, and it seems to be the lower sort of teams, like Division 3, Division 4 teams that are training this 5-6 nights a week to try and bridge the gap at the top. When you speak to the players that are playing Division 1, you know, I've been lucky. I'm doing a course at the minute through the GPA, you know, a leadership course, and, you know, there's Dublin footballers, you know, Monaghan footballers, Tyrone, Tipperary hurlers, and, you know, they have the balance right, you know, from their management teams and from down, where it's, you know, they train hard and, you know, they're the top teams, but, you know, they realise that rest and recovery is just as much, it's just as crucial as running around a pitch or doing a hard session. You know,
player burnout is the new, but I think when player burnout first started to be addressed, I think they were thinking on it on a purely physical basis.
Yeah.
Boys are pulling hamstrings or doing SELs in training, what can we do? Not realising that one of the other things was the pressure people put on, the mental training.
I felt that was me, you know, I always say to people, and not sort of in a big headed way, I think, but the easiest part is playing.
Yeah.
You know, the easiest part of playing GA, whether it's club or county, is the playing part,
because that's the bit you enjoy.
That's a bit that takes, you know, you don't really have to think about it. It's that sort of you know, second nature now. But it's all the other side of it, you know, traveling, you know, playing friendlies, you know, traveling up the, you know, people say, oh, you train at 7:30, it's on for an hour and a half, but ultimately you'll leave the house an hour before to beat traffic, to be there to sort of do you know, a pre-warm-up, and then the time you have food after, you know, you're talking 4 or 5 hours every night, and then the time you drive home, you're still wide awake. It affects your sleep, affects you getting up for work the next day, and then you have to do it all again. So it itself could be, you know, nearly a vicious circle too, like, so just making sure the players and management teams are keeping an eye on the players too, and not just running them into the ground just because apparently everyone else is doing it. So
I, yeah, well, player welfare is something that's very hard to manage, and I've seen teams where it's been really badly mismanaged, like, you know, star player's been out injured, but we're going to bring him back, and you're like, you're going to risk that man's fitness, health and livelihood to give you 20 minutes of a game, where if you just leave him alone for 2 weeks, he'll be back full fit.
I think now as well, you know, you hear from them top teams as well, that they have different sort of protocols in place, where, you know, they have apps, or they have like a group or a sort of something where they can relay how they're feeling before a session, you know, physically and mentally, because you don't know what players are going through. And I that's something I've sort of learned the last sort of 18 months or 19 months from sort of going public with it all. You don't know who, you could be sitting next to someone in the change room who you think you've known for a long time, but you don't know what they're going through, and going to training or going to play that match might be their escape. And I think it's vital for managers and other sort of players to be aware of just who's around you, and, you know, looking at body language, and, you know, does he look all right, or he's not the same, and just going over and asking people, because to say somebody could be having a real bad, could be having difficulty with, like, say, for example, a gambling problem or a drink problem, which is becoming more and more prevalent, or drugs or whatever it may be, or as you mentioned earlier, relationship breakdown, they may just be going to training that night, just, right, I don't have to think about it for an hour and a half. So, and the last thing, if a manager starts giving them a sort of ball tune, or, you know, turn into them, you know, it can make them worse. You don't know what, you could be sending them home in an even worse state. So I think it's just being that's something that I've be definitely more aware of as well. Like, you know, even having a bit of crack with people, you know, you don't know what they're going through. Like, so it's, I think it's always important just to make sure you're looking out for teammates. And
as we said, like, we talked about when me and yourself were just having that coffee, and we were talking about what to do after football, and I said, you're going to be a manager, and you were like, definitely not.
No, I wouldn't. I don't know, you know, if it was St. Gall's, maybe, you know, it's something maybe along the lines, but, you know, you'd have so much to look after, and there'd be so much, you know, it's a full-time job as well, you know, kits, trying to organise pitches, training, having to let people down, having to tell people that they're not playing for X, Y, and Z, you know, it's a very difficult job too. But, you know, you, even at county level now, the backroom staff is so big now, you know, you're talking, you know, between 10 and 20 people. So surely there's people there that should be designated to be like, right, you just need to be the gap between the players and the management, where, you know, you're mingling with the players, but you're also feeding back to the managers and letting them know the sort of the feel of the group or individuals in general? Like,
one of the ones, because you've been sort of playing, as you say, all your adult life, you're in that, you pretty much played through the transition of Gaelic football to modern Gaelic football, which was weight sessions, new aspects of training, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Whenever I was, remember reading up about, you know, what teams do, because I came from a junior club where we just went, you train twice a week and you play a match on the weekend. Actually, yeah. 3 nights of the week.
That was it.
And then there was, we're going to meet for a recovery session Friday and go to the pools and the cold bath and stuff. And you're like, right, that's now 4 nights Definitely. A week. Uh-huh. And I'm on a junior team here, you know. You just want to play and enjoy it. My favourite time when I played football was abroad, because mm-hmm. I got into social football,
yeah,
which kind of felt like football years ago.
Yeah,
it was weird because it was, you know, like, if you win, sure, we'll go for a couple of pints.
Yeah.
And if we lose, we'll go for a couple of pints.
Yeah.
And it brought that fun aspect back in, but that might have been because I was part of the Irish community in a different place, and we'd meet up and play, and it was
a
lot less pressure. Oh, more enjoyable. Yeah. Like, now, there are people who compete and want to win there, but we now have such big populations in places like Australia, always have in America. Right. I played in Canada for, the club had a junior team and a senior team.
Yeah. So they were like, Boston as well. So that,
yeah, so it's... and. It's fun, right?
Yeah.
It brings that joy back into the game. You're like, I love doing this. I played on the junior team in Canada for St. Michael's, and our nickname was the Killer Bees.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It was just a good laugh, and that was a lot of Canadian-born players as well.
Yeah.
So I got to meet a lot of guys, and it helped me get
never have met, yeah.
That I would never have met.
Yeah.
And then I came back, and I played for a year back at my home club, Le Summon in Armagh, playing junior football, and I hated it.
Yeah.
Like, same as you, like, see, getting to play,
yeah, it's the best part.
It's the best part, but
yeah.
Everything else, you would have swore we were setting up to play Dublin in the All-Ireland final. I was like, this is not enjoyable.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, we finished like third or fourth in the league and got put out after 3 rounds. Who cares? You know,
yeah.
That kind of, it was just real horrible.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean.
And it wasn't a nice feeling. And to see boys get mismanaged and, boys knocking their pan in all year, and then somebody comes back and there's your jersey.
Yeah.
And you're like, what is that doing to lads?
I know.
So it's that, there's so much, as you say, you don't want to be a manager because there's so much to take care of.
No, definitely not a county level. Like, I suppose I was always lucky enough at St. Gall's. There was always a good atmosphere there, and that probably bred on the back of, you know, the success there too, and everyone sort of driving in the one direction. So it just depends too. Like, you know, there was always a good bunch of players there, a good core group of players too, that, you know, if older boys moved on and younger boys were coming in, there was never any sort of divides. You know, everyone was sort of
in the same boat. Would you ever find in with teams that have a degree of success, as you say, a team's success is everyone pulling in one direction? Do you think in those teams, the boys moving out know when to go sooner? Because teams maybe where they're less successful, but you might have a good player that'll stick around for years and years and years, and then there is no youngster
influx,
behind them.
It's a difficult one too. Like, I mean,
it's such a juggling act.
It is, and it's all on the individual too. You know, it depends. You know, if somebody's there for so long and they're not married, they've no kids, then why not? What else do you do? I think when you start getting married and having kids, and you know, your time starts getting reduced to what you normally would have done where you were playing at that level, it's hard to sort of keep that going. So I got to the end of the stage with Antrim where it was like, you know, I love playing the championship matches, but it was always the dread of the likes of going to league games away, you know, away to Waterford, especially playing Division 4, away to Limerick, 7-8 hours in a bus.
Then to play a match,
and then like you were leaving at midday on a Saturday and getting back at midnight on a Sunday night, and then getting into work the next day, where that part of it wasn't enjoyable. Obviously, going to play championship matches and against some of the best teams in Ulster, who went on to win Ulster and stuff, was really good. And you know, representing St. Gall's on that stage and all, it was great too. Like, so, it's a juggling act, and then it just felt for me like, you know, I went back last year and watched one match and didn't watch another game. So. And I didn't miss it. You know, I wasn't ever thinking, God, I'd love to be playing, or I wonder, going training. I was able to focus then solely on St. Gall's, and prior to getting the knee injury, it was probably the best I'd been playing. You know, I had that sole focus. All my energy was going just to St. Gall's. I was going to the gym in the mornings, was able to train Tuesday and a Friday, training session or a match at the weekend, all within a half a mile of my house. So you know, you're just fresher and then you're actually chomping at the bit to get
from
training.
In your own personal experience, you've just touched on two things that I want to sort of tackle you on. Number one, you talk about having different focus. You getting married this year or next year?
Next year.
Getting married next year.
Yeah.
Which will also be the year you're trying to come back with this knee injury.
Yeah.
So what's the juggling act there? We'll talk. It's not just a knee injury. This was a surgical procedure.
Yeah, I done my cruciate there. At the start of July, just sort of last minute of a half, against Craig and Kickhams, who are one of the top teams in Antrim. As far as memory, you know, goes, I'm near sure we're winning by a point when I went off, and then Kieran McGordy went in the nets for the second half and we lost by 16. So I'm not saying I'm a one man team, but it's a good 17 point swing there, like. So I think it made Kieran realise, for all the slagging he gave me over the years about doing goals and this, that and the other, that there was a good baptism of fire for him. So it worked out well for.
I was going to say, more so, that definitely sounds like you're now going to be indicted in some sort of boogie scandal.
17-point turnaround. But
17-point turnaround. You're just like, when we're up by a point, I faked any injury and I'm going to Barbados, my honeymoon.
No, I wish. So it's not until next November. So no, I'm hoping to be back before then. Like, you know, right, probably so the start of the league.
What is an official time for a cricket? There's no, I mean,
eight,
I know.
It's sort of 8 to 9 months.
8 to 9 months.
Operation done at the 3 weeks ago, 3.5 weeks ago. So
it's so weird, obviously, because so many players now are doing their cruciate, because obviously it wasn't invented till 1998. So
I know. I think just players, just it's one of those things. I'd say it was much more sort of, you know, when you done your cruciate, say 20, 30 years ago, that was it. It was game over. Whereas now, you know, your neighbours actually up the street there at the Belfast Knee Clinic are, you know, the top boys at doing it, like. So yep. You know, I was lucky. I had the surgeon, Chris Connolly, who's regarded as probably the best knee surgeon in the country, like. So I was lucky enough. You know, it's still something I wouldn't wish on my worst enemy to get done, but you know, it's went well, and you know, rehab started. So
were you worried? Well, obviously, look, the what's going through your mind when you initially do the injury or something, were you ever worried about maybe slipping back into a bad mental place because you wouldn't have that distraction?
Well, I think I suppose
like, what now, because you obviously had that focus.
I suppose at the time the biggest thing was that I done just straight away was just sort of, you know, assumed the worst was going to be and accepted it straight away, like, just like, there's nothing else I can do here, like, you know, I'm in good hands. I go to, I'm seeing the top sort of consultant, going to a top physio for the rehab and stuff. So I suppose, like, you know, it was good. Now, I took the positives out of it, to go, you know, this is a good chance for me to come back better. It shows I can bounce back from another setback, so to speak. I suppose there is people out there that they do get injuries, that it's easy to go, you know, that's it, then they can go down, they can fall down. But I've sort of embraced it and went, well, do you know what, I'm gonna come back. And the more people spoke to me, like, I mean, I've only turned 33 and I do goals as well, like, so I could, you know, I could really play them 40 realistically if I, you know, no more injuries, or, you know, look after myself. So I think the more and more people be like, well, that's, you retired now, or, you know, you should retire. I think the more and more you just go, well, you'll see. So
if it makes you feel any better, I'm 34, but I run like I'm 40.
Well,
so you'll be fine.
I'm 33 and get out of bed in the mornings, feel like I'm about 93, like, so.
Right, but that's all part of recovery. But the whole point is, from your counselling and from your own experience, do you think that you're sort of newfound lease of life? I know you've got a lot coming up. Do you think maybe you developed some sort of coping skills from the positivities of what you come out of?
Definitely as well. I think even being...
Because you were just thinking, this is not as bad as what's happened to me.
Definitely. I mean, I said sort of straight away, you know, I've got over worse things in my life. Not got over them, but, like, you know, I've learned to deal with not having my dad passing away. So it's, I knew I was always going to come back if, you know, I've a lot of good friends and, you know, a very supportive fiance as well. So, and you know, it was always going to be in a good place. I've friends that have done it and come back better too, so there's no reason why I can't do it too.
Okay. You mentioned there your fiance, obviously an absolute legend because she's
from Armagh.
From Armagh. But she's not trying to get you to move down there like a half man from her mommy's, get you to transfer clubs, all that crap, no?
What conversation comes up, you know, every time I go around their kitchen table.
You'll not be doing a Billy Joe Paddon and moving out of Mayo to Armagh.
Armagh's 40 minutes away, like, so, you know, there's people, Ronan Gallagher done it for years with St. Gulls playing as well. But, you know, there's nothing really set in stone that I've been made aware of.
Nobody's told you?
Nobody's told me. It's every, like, people are asking me all the time, you know, how's the wedding plans going? How do I know? Like,
I have bad news. You'll be told after the wedding. This is how our mad women work. And don't answer it back. You'll regret it for the rest of your life.
I know. Wear a gum shield 24/7.
Superb. What... So moving forward, you want to come back, and as you said, you can keep going. From being a former county footballer and playing at that high level, your Division One Antrim club, and you've done Ulster campaigns and All Ireland campaigns. Do you have any sort of general advice for? You don't even have to play Gaelic football. I think for any sports person, how do you keep yourself right? Because the main point is we all play sport because we enjoy it.
Yeah.
At that level, how do we cut through the bullshit to what we enjoy?
Just sort of, you know, it's, I suppose it's hard to, like, you know, I would always be a pretty positive person, you know, and try not to get, you know, it's very easy to get surrounded by negative players or drainers, as they're called, you know, always thinking, talking about the worst, whereas, you know, with St. Gaul's, I keep referring to, you know, it's always that same group, always had the same sort of idea, and it was never really spoke about, it was just sort of nearly ingrained in us, and it was always just sort of, it was contagious. It made people want to go, do you know what, I want to play on that team, or I want to do what he's done, or, you know, I want to play alongside him. So that was always, you know, my sort of reasons. Like, it wasn't really anything sort of, I always wanted to try and be the best goalkeeper I could. Always wanted to sort of, how I could, you know, things I could change or adapt for the better of the team or the personnel in the team as well. Like, so it was just sort of straightforward for me. Like, in terms of, like, injuries, I think the biggest thing is just sort of accepting them. You know, I think the worst thing is that you're trying to convince yourself it's not too bad. I'll be back here and there. Whereas I just went, right, you know, I've 8-9 months now to get back. How can I help? You know, the boys were playing in Championship, or how can I help them in another way? Or put the energy into the team in another way, where it was sort of, whether it was throwing water on the pitch or doing sports massages or whatever it may be, just to sort of to help out and still feel like you're involved in a different capacity.
So do you think that's, personally speaking, if you're talking about sort of that's slow move out, like you're never gonna, some people just retire from football and they're done, they're not seen around the club. You think you'll move into that, not management, but maybe coaching?
Yeah, possibly.
Helping, you know, bringing on a new generation, maybe going back further and trying to bring the next people in?
Yeah, possibly, yeah. Or, you know, I do have a big passion for the sort of strength and conditioning side of the game as well, and the recovery side with doing sports massage and that as well. So whether it's in that capacity or, you know, helping with goalkeeping, coaching, I'm not too sure either, like, so. But for the meantime, I'll probably just try and play for as long as I can once I get back.
Cool. The fun fact that I wanted to talk about was, did you do nets in the last competitive match in Casement Park?
Yes.
You did. And when was that?
2013.
Yeah. For those of you listening, outside of Ulster or outside of Antrim or... Like, I'm not even an Antrim man, and I think it's a horrendous thing.
It's shocking.
Where were you playing your last home games, Armagh?
The last championship game there Antrim played was in Armagh, yeah.
Yeah, and then your backdoor qualifier was...
It's at Currigan, St. John's.
St. John's, like, that's mental. There's a whole generation of Antrim footballers and hurlers that are missing out on what used to be probably the best kept pitch in the country.
Yeah, the surface and all was unreal, and, you know, everyone would say, you know, they love playing in Casement, and it was just a sort of a vocal point where you could call a home ground, and, you know, St. John's and with the football, and Ballycastle with the hurling have done a really good job, but you know, it's just not the same, and you know, the sooner it gets sorted the better. And yeah, that's another issue where we're saying about Stormont not sitting, and it's all up in the air, and you know, nobody really knows what's going on. And you know, I drive past it twice a day going to and from work, and just it's shocking the way it sits now at the minute. And when you look across the road or you go to games at, you know, Ravenhill or at Windsor, and you see the new brand new stadiums they have, and you know, I think Belfast and Antrim GAA are crying out for that themselves.
Yeah, I think with the Belfast thing you were saying, with and always going back to what we talked about, which was the purpose of the podcast, which was the mental health services. It's brilliant because in West Belfast there are, what did we say, 16 clubs?
We talked 16 clubs, I think, in
West Belfast alone. That's a lot of people learning new things, being kept busy, and learning social skills.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
So this
yeah.
is something, do you think maybe there's going to, I mean, we have like child protection officers and Irish language officers. Do mm-hmm. you see something in the future we might have a mental health officer, a qualified counsellor?
Definitely, it's something like, you know, a lot of clubs now have health and wellbeing forums or health and wellbeing officers. But you know, we'll have doctors, we'll have physios that come on the pitches to help out. So there could be someone in each club designated to be, you know, a mental health first aider. I've done it in the course in work as well. Or, you know, someone that they can go to that's sort of can point them in the right direction if they're, regardless of the issue they're coming with, that they can go, right, I might not know all the answers, but I can signpost you to the right place or the right professionals.
So this is something that we're going to be looking at in the future. Do you think maybe as current generations or people who are more educated in the field get into, say, county boards, you know, central committees, all that kind of stuff, that will be, because the GAA, I mean, the way it works is we have the tiers and we have at the bottom level amazing volunteers that drive each club.
Yeah.
And then the people who, but like county boards and sitting on boards of clubs is, it's hard work. It's,
yeah.
There's a lot of what's the point kind of stuff. So people, somebody has to get high enough to petition this at a higher level.
Yeah.
Which would be people like the GPA or.
Yeah, no, the GPA do push it as well. And, you know, they release all their sort of annual reports on how many players have contacted them and availed of the services. But, I think more and more, especially when you're even universities as well, you know, with the loss of the two students last week as well, I think, you know, having those in the universities now too, because one of the worst things that happened to us is smartphones and social media. I know I mentioned earlier about the positivity of the social media can have, but, you know, there's so much now where people can, you know, make themselves paranoid and stuff, and you know, you're buried in your phone, and the sort of losing the face-to-face conversations that people used to have. If you look around, everyone's on their phones or on a laptop or an iPad or something. So younger people now growing up have a lot more stresses than, you know, what it would have been like when we were growing up. So
thanks for making me feel older with that advice too, Chris. We'll wrap up with just sort of a wee chat because we talked about that. So we've been very GAA focused because that's where we come from. You've obviously played at the much higher level than me, but I'm like the bug, the country boy, making up the numbers guy. So we've talked about sort of services that are available once you get to certain levels and places you can go. If you are listening and you are playing in any sport at all, so whether you're a sports person or not, if you aren't a sports person, or it's probably a good start to go and find out what your association offers.
Yeah.
If you there's got to be something. If you're a rugby player, see what the IRFU has, or if you're a soccer player, see if the IFA or the FAI are offering every services. The main thing is, if you're having a bad time and it's in your head, you spend a lot of time in your head, so it can be a very hard thing to even look outside for help. Never mind asking for help.
Yeah.
Because I think I've definitely had it. You've had it. The main thing is that sort of education and actually knowing what services are around.
Yeah, the IRFU, they have set up by a few of the players. They have an app called Tackle Your Feelings as well, which is a good idea too.
That's class.
Jack McGrath, he was quite open about his own mental health struggles. Ex-Leinster, so he's now Ulster, and the Ireland prop, along with a few other players, set this up so you can sort of it's like a diary where you can keep sort of on top of how you're feeling, and you know, there is services there, and you know, the one sort of pro of smartphones is that you can Google and search, you know, services near me or what's available to me. You'd be very surprised how many there actually is, and how easy they are to access. I think the biggest step is, the hardest step, sorry, is the first step, is actually going, you know what, I'm going to go, sort of the realization that there is something wrong. I think if you deny it and go through that stage, nah, I'm grand, and push it off and make it sort of feel worse, or if you self-medicate, I drink drugs, and it starts really getting out of control, where I think if you can realize that there's something not right, you know, straight away, and you can go and get that help, maybe even just a 5-minute chat with a GP or a nurse or whatever it may be, can just be that sort of relief, and then you can start, you know, getting the proper help that's needed.
Cool. Well, so if you are listening to this, and if you're feeling low, I hope this has helped you in some way, because we've talked about our own personal experiences. There are services out there. Do get in touch, even if it comes to it, go and say, you just go and tell somebody that you're not feeling great. There will always be somewhere that people, I think the whole thing is people are always posting up on their Facebooks and their socials, you know, if you need to talk to me, avail of that. It might not be a professional service, but if it's your best mate or your a parent or anybody, the main thing is to tell somebody, and it's that realization, because you're suffering alone. I think the main realization is once you find out that you are not alone, hopefully that'll help somebody.
I think the thing is, you hear people saying a problem shared is a problem halved. You know, if it means you're telling someone you trust or a friend, that they'll go, 9 times out of 10, they'll go, well, if you need to go somewhere, I'll go with you, or I'll drive you there, or I'll sit in a coffee shop and wait on you. Or I think if you have like a good support network around you, and that just sort of always remember that there is so many people that want to help, and that there's always light at the end of the tunnel, and the hardest step's the first step. Like, so.
I think my personal experience, and just where I come from, my recommendation for anybody, because they've just helped so many people in my local community, the PIPS office in Newry.
Yep.
PIPS are national, aren't they?
Everywhere.
They're everywhere, because you've done talks with them, and you've met the organisers. And
the founder, Philip Taggart, he started in North Belfast after the passing of his son through suicide. It was 17 years ago. His name was Philip too, and his nickname was Pip. So that was the idea behind it, and it's very accessible. You can call it, the numbers are all online. There's a lot of other good charities in and around Belfast, the likes of Tammy, Inspire Wellbeing, Aware NI, are all very easy to get in contact with, and are all at the end of the phone waiting to help.
That's cool. I just wanted to sort of, if you had a list of recommendations, and that's a brilliant starting point for anybody, I think. Yeah. So no problem. I think we'll leave it there, but I hope you've enjoyed. I hope we were somewhere informative. I hope we were a bit of crack, because it's a hard subject to broach, but I think if we can talk about it openly, and I always find as a comedian, if we can have a giggle about something, then maybe it's not as bad as we thought.
Yeah.
I think that's a big deal with mental health.
Definitely.
No problem. I hope this has helped you. If you need help, or if you know someone who does, just say, I've got a wee podcast for you to check out. This is just us talking about our sort of shared experience kind of thing. Chris, anything to add?
No, I just want to say thanks for having us, and hopefully it can help in some way, shape or form.
No problem. We'll do a follow-up whenever you're living in Armagh next year.
Okay?
I'll call down and see you, because I can just nip up to my mass for a cup of tea on the way home. No problem. Thanks for listening, guys. And Chris, thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
See you later, guys.